This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. The federal government recently made history by issuing a national apology for failing thousands of survivors of institutional child sexual abuse. Addressing federal parliament late last month, Prime Minister Scott Morrison said that while nothing can be done to right the wrongs of the past, as a nation it's time to confront our failure to listen, to believe and to provide justice. The apology followed a five-year Royal Commission which exposed horrific abuse of children at institutions around the country and systemic attempts to cover it up. The inquiry heard from 17,000 survivors, of which 8,000 recalled their abuse in private sessions. More than 14% of respondents came from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. Among them were survivors of both the Cootamundra Girls Home and the Kinchla Boys Home in rural New South Wales. Both institutions gained notoriety for the poor treatment of children in their care during the national inquiry into the stolen generations in the mid-1990s. Dr. Tiffany McComsey is the CEO of the Kinchla Boys Home Corporation, and she joins me now, along with members of the Stolen Generations, Uncle Michael Welsh and Uncle Kerry McKenzie. Uncle Michael, what did the apology from Scott Morrison mean to you?
I got to say it was lovely to see so many down there. That was the biggest good feeling that I got from it. As apologies have sort of been coming free and easy lately, and so I was a little bit, skeptical about it in my own way, but he did go through a lot, and one of the things that I felt, and when we got back onto the bus, we're talking to the other brothers, other people that went through the same thing, that there was too many sorries in there. In the old 15 minutes or whatever he spoke for, there were a couple of areas that he didn't say anything about, which hurt not only myself in the purpose of what they were trying to do, I would imagine, but there were quite a few others that were in the crowd that were singing out and asked. I've got to say it because I know. They asked about why he identified all the schools, all the churches, all the families, all the paedophilia that was happening in there, in the house and the families. He didn't say nothing about the army or the police force, and that was something that I'm not picking on them, but the fact is that if you're going to apologise to people about things that happened to you, you best cover the old truth about the old lot of it. And so it was a little bit sad in the area that he didn't cover enough of the issues, and it just seemed to be that it was, again, them putting themselves in the spotlight.
And what about you, Uncle Kerry? What did it mean to you? What were your reflections?
You've got me on the hop now because I actually missed the apology, but I mean, as apologies go in the past, it's kind of a wait-and-see thing. The one big apology with Kevin Rudd was I'm a bit bewildered because it was so much publicised and everything like that, but there hasn't been much done, and there's a lot to be done because there's a lot of issues with Aboriginal people, and as I've learnt in the past, Aboriginal people are the most legislated people in the world, and there hasn't been much consultancy with Aboriginal people about how they would like to address things. But my thing with apologies is it's a bit like waiting for a train, and if it's late, they apologise, and the next day it's the same thing and nothing gets done. And my understanding of an apology is you make an about face and you rectify it, and none of that has happened.
One of the things the Prime Minister said in his apology was the words, "We believe you."
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
I'm a bit, it's again, wait and see thing. We believe you, but I know I'm of the next generation of the stolen generation, and our voice has not been heard. And a lot of people are kind of surprised to find out that they were still taking kids away in the 60s and in the 70s, which I was taken in the early 60s.
And I guess one of the things that people did note was that there seems to be a lot of promises that came with this apology, for example, commitment to a museum, reparations, that weren't on the table at the time of Kevin Rudd's apology. Does that make you feel like things have progressed, or does it still raise questions for you?
We've done a lot of self-healing and self-counselling and through the Kinchler Boys and Aboriginal Corporation, and together as we get together with brothers. And the apology by Rudd was something that the moment of it was said, it gave me the feeling that you could go back home to your homeland and feel as though people, again, like Morrissey said, we believe you. And those words are, at the moment, just words, you know, believe your words. And the thing with and reparation, they talk about that, it's the way that they handled that and the way that they did it, it's an insult to not only just the ones that are stolen generation that are survivors, but to the next descendants of the brothers that we've lost who still carry this trauma, generational trauma, in a big way, and they've got also the wives or the de factos or whatever. They're the ones that are caught up in this trauma. And while these people are only just looking at one little peephole through the key, they're missing out on what we believe our purpose is that, you know, we need to rebuild a family structure that they broke. And we can't do that because all of the practices of a life as you're going through it were taken away from us. And not only just their culture and our languages, but the ability to be able to function in society in general. It's something that is sadly missed with us. It's not our purpose, but we, through the reprogramming that they did to do to us for to the way they wanted it, they need to understand that this is not just our problem, but it's our lives.
I want to get back to that experience, but just, Tiffany, I might just ask you, what have you observed from your position as CEO in terms of the general response to the apology from survivors?
I think it was very different to Kevin Rudd's apology, and I don't think it was as well understood or promoted as Kevin Rudd's apology was. And I think it's a very challenging apology to share at the community level. But to be trauma-informed and to really support the survivors who had the courage to speak to the Royal Commission, more respect should have been shown to them to encourage the community to really respond well and appropriately. Here in New South Wales, it was a shame that there was a viewing at the Opera House. But again, it felt like everything was very rushed, so we couldn't really help survivors get to the apology or even have live feeds out in communities. And a lot of the survivors are old, and so in residential homes where they are living almost another nightmare by being in an institution, more supports, I think, could have been given.
Uncle Michael, you mentioned before that your life's been shaped by your experiences at Kinchler. What would you want, particularly younger people who might not know all they need to know about the impact of those policies and what it was like for somebody like you? What of your experience would you like them to know?
Our actions in the way that we reacted in an issue or a problem in general, whatever. My own children, now I understand and I see it with them. Because of what happened to me, I lost the feeling that this country is no longer part of me, that I got slammed away from it. So I worked hard and the nights wouldn't leave me alone, so the mind, I turned to alcohol and I felt good as long as for a while, but then I'd black out from it and I'd go into things and I'd do things while I was in a black mode and that were unbelievable. And I couldn't let my children for a long time to tell me about it. But as time went by, I come through the other side of whatever that traumatised Bart, and I'm on a better pathway of healing. So in that, I listen to my children when they're talking now, and they talk about those things that I've had, and I've done. And in saying that, they're caught up into the same pattern of life. And I've finished up in and out of the jail system because I felt more comfortable while I was in there, because it was a place where I had a bed, I had a feed, I had somebody doing things, locking me in. Sounds stupid, but the fact is that out in the community itself, I had a problem because I had the ability to be able to hark's taken away from me, and I had the ability to be able to make a decision for myself taken away from me. All of those came through their punishments and the bashings and the starving, and these were things that not being able to talk about from them for a long time, it just built up and kept building up. So now, right here now, you are helping me to understand me more, to heal me more, so that I could have a little bit of happiness in my life. I didn't know how to be a father. I didn't know any of those things. I knew how to, make my children stand up like little soldiers and get dressed and do it. All of the things that that place did to me, I took that to my own home. And it finished up being a terrifying experience for my children and myself.
Uncle Kerry, what is it from your experience that you would like people to know in terms of their deeper understanding of what life was like for somebody like you who was affected by that policy?
I really, trying to get into people's minds is a fairly difficult thing. I'm not trying to express it in the best way I can, but for me, that we exist and we're affected by it, by whatever our circumstances. We're all victims of circumstances. And so my experience in the institutions is they make issues about chickens being in boxes and things like that, and human beings are not, they're pretty much the same. Homes are like they're like factories. And the way they deal with them, because the emotional attachment to the house parents or the matrons is a hands-off approach, and where we all know that kids didn't need to be hugged, whatever the situation. And then a lot of times when I kind of injured myself or had a problem, they'd say, "Oh, what are you whinging about, you big baby? Go away." And so we had to kind of find out for ourselves how to best deal with our circumstances and how we were brought up. And for me, I kind of brought that back into my older life, that I'm still a fairly kind of private person, and trying to express it, I've always found very difficult, and I remember once where I was in a hostel, and this woman said to me, she was a cleaner, and she said to me, "Kerry, were you raised in an institution?" I said, "Why?" She said, your room's immaculate. And she says, "I go to everybody else's rooms and they're all thing." So there were little quirks that I do and I don't mean to do. Another one was people came up and give me a hug and I'd jam up. And if people didn't know about it, I'd use my Aboriginality as an excuse for why I jammed up. But it was a result of actually the way I was brought up. And I'm still finding out as I'm getting in my older years that it's still things that I'm finding that are part habits or traits that from being institutionalised. And as I say, institutions, they're like factories and human beings. I'm always amazed how Sydney has all these apartments and high-rises and everything like that and boxes, and I just think, that's not the way it was meant to be, but here we are.
Tiffany, we hear these stories, they're profoundly moving, more than hearing the statistics or the policy, they bring home what the impact of those policies were on people's lives. One of the recommendations that's flowed from the apology this week is the idea of a museum. From your perspective, how useful will that be to tell the particulars of that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander experience in a museum that generally deals with issues of children's abuse in institutions?
I think any national or state museum that tried to cover all of that would really not be able to tell the story as it is. Here in New South Wales, Kinchula Boys Home, Cootamundra Girls Home and Bomaderry were all heritage listed as sites of significance and as Aboriginal places. And at each of those sites, each of the survivor groups have identified the need for a museum to exist there, to tell the specific story. And we found, going back to Kinchula Boys Home site and having Sorry Day commemorations there and other activities, it's about the uncles sharing their story of their experiences where they took place. And that's really where you get the depth of this knowledge. And I think the state and federal government should really look at investing in those site-specific keeping places, museums, because it's really there where you get an understanding of what happened. And in the case of Kinchula Boys Home, we've also thought the need for a mobile education centre where we're actually going back to the communities where the uncles were taken from, because part of this for the Stolen Generation survivors is about reconnecting back to country, community, where they were taken from. And there's so many stories that are still haven't been told, need to be recorded. And it's linking the uncles and families back to communities, but also the communities to Kinchula Boys Home in Kempsey. Because it's that shared history and story that needs to be reconnected to really understand the depth of what happened.
And actually, that brings me to the next question I wanted to ask, because it always strikes me when you listen to those personal stories that both uncles have shared with us this evening, that there's a generosity about your sharing that. It's not easy for you to talk about it. They're very moving stories. It's important for us to hear it. It seems that the bravery that you have to tell these stories as men of what's happened to you, there's a strength that comes from the fact that Kinchula boys have come together to share that experience. How important has that been as part of your healing process, that other people, other men who had that same experience, now walk a journey with you?
Huge in every way. Any one words or sentence would never be able to explain the where it takes us. As we all, the majority of us, all have families and children's, and we weren't able to be able to speak and share our love with our children in the way that general people or people across the land are brought up to in a loving family. As like Kerry just mentioned, as cuddling is something that I do deliberately, because I did the same thing when I got home with my grandmother and my mother. They come up and cuddled me. I didn't know what to do. I shook like a tiny little and terrified me. But the fact is that I do it now everywhere I go, because they ask me to, and I feel that it's more, it's our people's way of learning to do it. And I do it to my children, and I do it to the KVH brothers when we got back together. I had some reactions to that, I can tell you that, you know, our fearful ones, but it's one of those things that as a group of brothers, when we come together, it is so unique in its own way, and I understand that now, but there's no judgment there. we don't judge each other. We know each other. We understand each other. And even in saying that, we have the different cultures that's a little bit aligned, but we've also developed our own brotherhood and culturehood in our own ways, to where how to joke and how to be and where not to be. Not if the brother over here, not to be with him, be with the other one. So it's a pattern of a small scale of us as out into the real world. It's a lot more difficult to us to be able to find what we need or to be able to function as if we talk, we're talking to somebody, we look at somebody and we see their eyes and all of a sudden their eyes change because we've just said something that we don't understand. I suppose one of the best ways I could explain it is that when I got home, they seen little Michael, now I was big Michael, as I'd be speaking to them, I opened my mouth up, their eyes changed. I had a different voice tone. I had a different structure of language. My way of talking was different from my community, my family. The communities, families have temperaments that is designed and developed while you're growing up with them. And we, as brothers, when we get together, we fall back in. That's a beautiful feeling. It's a easier feeling with each other. So that's where we are when we're going on the journey of togetherness. That's lovely. But then we have our children that are still struggling to understand that. So our movement at the moment is to broaden that, to be able to get them into a safe space of understanding.
And Uncle Kerry, where do you get that strength from? What have been the important, the important lifelines for you in terms of you being able to speak and share your story?
I guess I get it from seeing, like Uncle Michael and others, as being role models, and I get great strength in that. And there's a brotherhood of, I know when I catch up with guys I grew up with, we might have been bullied or whatever, but when we get together, we all classify ourselves as brothers and sisters. And so I get strength in that. And I guess it's also Aboriginal people are very strong and, you know, we've been through a lot. And I put it down to sometimes I'm basically cheeky, you know. I think to myself that, you know, there's a bit of an arrogance there that they look and say, well, is that the best you could throw at me? And I kind of keep that kind of attitude that, you know, that we're Aboriginal people are fairly strong and we've been around here for, was it 40,000 years or something like that? I don't know. There's all these numbers being chucked around and we're going to be here around for a lot more. And I think that I get great strength in seeing like Uncle Michael and the rest and kinship. And I'm glad to be part of their organisation. And I guess Michael's been throwing around a few, Uncle Michael's been throwing a few words around calling us the others. So yeah. It might be a new word for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always a privilege to hear those stories. Tiffany, I just wanted to ask you finally tonight, the last time we had you on the program was a time when the New South Wales government had just released a report recommending compensation for members of the Stolen Generation. Can you just give us a bit of an update on how that process progressed?
Yeah. So a reparations package was agreed to, and in New South Wales, Stolen Generation survivors were provided with a $75,000 compensation payment and an additional $7,000 to assist with funeral costs. And a person could choose to accept that money right away or wait till they've passed and their estate could help have that money accessed. It's been a useful process for those who went through some of the well-known institutions. Where there have been some difficulties is where the person was removed not by the Aborigines Protection or Welfare Board, but by the mainstream child welfare department. And those individuals have had a harder time of having to demonstrate that they were still removed under the policies that created the Stolen Generations. And that's an ongoing process that Aboriginal Affairs continues to try to work through currently.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show this evening, Tiffany. And I just also want to once again thank you, Uncle Michael, and you, Uncle Kerry, for giving us the privilege of hearing your stories and sharing your experiences. Such an important national story. We're very proud to have it on Speaking Out this evening. Dr. Tiffany McComsey is the CEO of the Kinchula Boys Home Corporation, and Uncle Michael Welsh is a survivor of the Kinchula Boys Home, while Uncle Kerry McKenzie is a survivor of the Stolen Generations who was also raised in childcare institutions.